My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine. My fellow plebs, today's podcast is also brought to you by Moon Mortgage. As the world moves increasingly towards the mainstream adoption of Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage makes it possible to materialize your assets into real estate. Through the collateralization of mortgages with Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage will be launching lending solutions to allow investors to easily leverage their assets to purchase investments in owner-occupied property. Moon Mortgage's crypto mortgage will be launching soon for home buyers in Texas, Florida, and Colorado, and will also be open to investors in most states across the U.S. for investment properties. Welcome to the future of mortgages. Visit moonmortgage.com today to register and learn more. Moon Mortgage Residential is registered with the NMLS under number 235334. Today's episode is brought to you by Gordon Law Group. If you've tried to do Bitcoin taxes yourself, you know how complicated it is. You can spend hours and hours going through your transactions and researching tax forms, and you're still not sure if it's right or if the IRS will come after you. Or maybe you're so intimidated by Bitcoin taxes that you don't even know where to start. Gordon Law Group can help. Ditch the spreadsheets and feel confident with a bulletproof Bitcoin tax return. They can help with IRS payment plans, and they also provide a full range of legal and accounting services for Bitcoin and digital asset startups. Get your taxes done right the first time with the original Bitcoin and digital asset tax pros. Go to GordonLawLTD.com/BTC. As a bonus, they'll send you the ultimate Bitcoin tax guide for free. That's GordonLawLTD.com/BTC.
How's it going?
Hey, CK, it's going great, man. How are you?
It's going great. Happy to be here. Excited for this conversation with the legend, Parker.
Yeah, really looking forward to this. So Parker, I'm going to put some of his articles up in the nest, but he has some of the most formative pieces on Bitcoin for me. Really lays it out in relatively plain English, making the case for Bitcoin in an incredibly persuasive way. And, you know, I think now with everything we have going on with this banking crisis, you know, it's as good a time as ever to be discussing these topics. So really looking forward to digging into his Gradually Then Suddenly series, which I imagine a lot of people in the audience will be familiar with. But for those who are not, this will be a great introduction.
Yeah, I agree. You know, Parker's helped me out a bunch with his series. And yeah, it's probably one of my favorite series, as many people in the space. But before we get into that, what are you guys looking forward to at Bitcoin 2023? I'll kick it over to CK and then maybe Spencer.
Yeah, no, definitely. So obviously the event, I think it's 57 days away. So it's coming pretty quick here. And we have a ticket price increase this Friday. So definitely use promo code COSMIC to save 10% and be at the biggest Bitcoin gathering of this bear market in potentially bear market history down in Miami. And, you know, it's going to be an absolutely incredible event. It's really, I call it the physical manifestation of Bitcoin every single year. David Bailey, our CEO, likes to think of it as the pilgrimage for Bitcoin and of the Bitcoin community. So yeah, like I said, don't miss it. Thousands of Bitcoiners strong have already bought tickets, planned their travel. Don't FOMO in when prices are much higher and get them today. Again, promo code COSMIC. And just to kind of like talk about some of the elements of the event that we have started to coalesce around and agree upon, and they're kind of getting ready for, is one is this idea of like having profiles for different types of and archetypes for different types of people that will be attending the event, and having sort of like a guide to, so like if you're a miner, a guide to all the best mining content, or if you're new to Bitcoin, maybe what stuff you should plan. So that is one element I'm really excited about. We're about to roll out our app as well, which is perfect for, you know, just the basics, like what is happening when, but also allows for incredible networking opportunities. We beta tested it at Bitcoin Amsterdam, and for folks who try to set up meetings, something like 60% were successful at getting responses and setting up meetings via our networking app. I know our own salespeople used it. So that's pretty awesome for the B2B folks too. So like I said, Bitcoin 2023, you know, we're really trying to make something for everyone at the event, whether you are there as a business or whether you are a Bitcoin pleb. So come and join us in 57 days over Miami Beach and celebrate the end of Bitcoin winter, and maybe celebrate being a part of the group of people that has been ahead of the curve in understanding what is happening with all the craziness in banking. And that definitely includes Parker too. So Parker, welcome up to the stage. Excited to be chatting with you.
Hey CK, good to be here.
So Parker, this is Cosmic Bitcoin. The show is about getting cosmic and thinking through kind of the big ideas around Bitcoin, you know, go beyond price predictions or anything like that, but think about how Bitcoin actually changes us, changes society, what that might look like and feel like and what people should expect. So you have, you know, made a really big impression on a lot of Bitcoiners and a lot of the biggest minds in the space with your Gradually Then Suddenly series. We have all the pieces pinned up to the top here. So we're really excited to kind of walk through a handful of these pieces, compare and contrast them, hear what your thoughts were about the general concepts, and then explore, you know, what happens when the world coalesces around what you're writing about, and what does that world potentially look like to you? So I think it's going to be an awesome conversation.
All right, I'm looking forward to it. We can get in wherever you want to.
Spencer, you want to jump in with a quick introduction here for Parker, and then we can jump in?
Yeah, sure thing. So yeah, Parker, as many people know, is a prolific writer on the Bitcoin, in the Bitcoin space. You know, most well known is his Gradually Then Suddenly series. I have links to quite a few of those pieces pinned up in the nest, so really recommend everyone check those out. You know, they're relatively straightforward, but super informative. And I know it's, you know, been great for a lot of people to wrap their heads around Bitcoin using these. So kudos to Parker for that. But Parker also is an advisor at Unchained Capital, one of the more well-known Bitcoin companies out there. They do an amazing job. And I'll also shout out to Ted Stevenow, my coworker, who recently joined the Bitcoin magazine team coming from Unchained. Shout out Ted. Parker is also an advisor for 1031 Venture Capital, doing a great job funding businesses in the Bitcoin space, and is also heavily involved with the Bitcoin Commons, the Bitcoin co-working and networking community in Nashville. So Parker is super involved, has been for a long time with the Bitcoin community. So we're really looking forward to, you know, getting him up here and picking his brain. And as I mentioned before Parker got here, it's, you know, with everything going on with this banking crisis, you know, QE infinity, quote unquote, potentially coming down the pipe, or, you know, a massive, I guess, deflationary event could be the other side of that coin. But there's, you know, economic fragility is on full display right now. So I think we're going to get into some of that to try to understand what it is about Bitcoin that makes it stable in relationship to the fiat system, which many Bitcoiners, I know, would argue is an inherently unstable economic system. So really looking forward to getting into that. And I think a good place to start to help people kind of wrap their minds around Parker's thought process is to try to understand what sets Bitcoin apart from fiat currency. And I think when a lot of people try to understand what money is, the first thing they try to think is, you know, what is money backed by? And it's kind of an interesting question. For a long time, obviously, the dollar was backed by gold. That convertibility is no longer the case, of course. And then, you know, people who are new to the space, they look at Bitcoin and they're like, what is Bitcoin backed by? And then conversely, they say, oh, you know, the dollar is backed by men with guns or the government. And Parker has kind of a bit of a counterintuitive approach, but one that makes a lot of sense to try to unpack, you know, what it is that backs, quote unquote, backs money. So Parker, would just love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and the only thing I would correct you on is that the Bitcoin Commons were here in Austin. I'm sitting in the TFTC studio right now with you guys. But other than that, appreciate the introduction, Spencer. And yeah, I can just dive right into it. So I think that, you know, the way that I frame you know, one, why Bitcoin is valuable, but then two, this idea of what backs Bitcoin. I think that, as you mentioned, the idea of something being backed by something really harkens back to the dollar being backed by gold, and the dollar is no longer backed by gold. And oftentimes people will say that Bitcoin isn't backed by anything, and the dollar is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government or, you know, guys with guns. But that when you really distill it down, that if originally the dollar was backed by gold, the question becomes what was gold backed by, and is that as a mental framework, does it even make sense? And at a fundamental level, it's really what caused gold to emerge as money, or what backed gold. And the way that I would put it is that that what backed gold and what backs Bitcoin is the credibility of its monetary properties, and that the same things that allowed gold to emerge as money both exist in and have been perfected in Bitcoin. And the most fundamental or foundational of the monetary properties is scarcity, and that Bitcoin is finitely scarce, and that there's a lot of things that give Bitcoin value, but the most important one in my mind is the fact that there will only ever be 21 million. That is the basis of its scarcity. And if you couldn't also divide and aggregate Bitcoin and send it permissionlessly, then it wouldn't be viable or valuable as money, but it also wouldn't have a credibly fixed supply if that was the case. So really the only thing that's ever backed any form of money is the properties that make it credible as money. And in Bitcoin, the most foundational of those is scarcity and the fixed supply of 21 million.
Parker, the world still doesn't really believe that Bitcoin has that 21 million hard cap. Like even Jamie Dimon, who people were clowning earlier this week, he's famous for questioning that, you know, shitcoiners and altcoiners frequently question that. What is it going to take for, you think, maybe like a stronger group of people or like a larger group of people to accept what we, you know, feel is a very credible monetary policy in Bitcoin?
I don't think that it's necessarily that people don't. I mean, I know that Jamie Dimon made the comment of, well, how do you know that there's only going to be 21 million? I say the vast majority of people don't know that is the signal, and that fewer people really understand its significance. And so I think that, you know, I'll kind of talk on both sides. One is as it relates to Jamie Dimon's comments, where he basically said, well, how do you know it will stop at 21 million? And I wrote a piece that I put on my blog, coiner.ghost.io, called Jamie Dimon 21 million Bitcoin. And I draw out two points. I draw out that one, Jamie Dimon implicitly admits that the 21 million supply cap is relevant. He just doesn't believe that it's credible. And that two, the way that he talks about it establishes that he doesn't really even have a framework as to how to think about it. The way he, you know, kind of spoke about it, it's like, how do you know when we get to 21 million that they won't keep printing or minting them? And in that piece, I lay out a framework to think about that really the right way to evaluate whether or not Bitcoin will only ever have 21 million is whether or not the next block will only have 6.25 Bitcoin, and that when we get the block 840,000, it will be 3.125 Bitcoin, and so on. And so it's not having to wait 100 years to find out. It's you have to be able to build a framework for why wouldn't the monetary policy change right now in the next block? Whatever would prevent Bitcoin from having its supply cap break would have to happen in the next block in order for it to happen ever, or said a different way, that if it ever were to happen, the same thing that would cause that could happen today. And so if you were answering that question, you would have to think about those principles. And there's just a reality that everyone has to accept that one, understanding Bitcoin is hard, and that two, money is hard to understand. And so I think that it's actually less to do about the credibility of Bitcoin's fixed supply. It's more people figuring out that there's a problem with their money, and that as they're seeking out a solution, that they look to Bitcoin. But the good thing is that the more people that stare at the equation, the more people come to the conclusion that Bitcoin is money, or that its fixed supply is credibly scarce, and that as more people come to that consensus, as the consensus grows, it actually becomes easier for more people to adopt Bitcoin as money, because the more people that have gone before, the less crazy or the easier it is to join the consensus, not just because there's better infrastructure and more infrastructure, but because as people start looking around their peers, it's not to say trust and don't verify. It's that as the consensus becomes more clear, it becomes easier for a larger consensus to grow because money is a problem that's solving trade and coordination. And, you know, trade is an inherently intersubjective problem. So I don't actually think it's a problem that people look at this equation and that it's, and that more people haven't already gotten there. It's like more people are getting there every day, and the more people that stare at it and the more events in the world that happen, like banks failing and banks being bailed out, the more only more people will figure it out. And the more people that are educating, writing, producing content, which more people are doing every day, it's just a natural course.
So on that topic of like the different functions of money, one we often harp on as Bitcoiners is this ability of money to store value over time. And I wanted to call attention to this recent President's Economic Report that came out the other day. And it says that Bitcoin cannot be a store of value because it's too volatile. And they make the claim that because Bitcoin is too volatile, therefore it is not money. And I think that that's, for normies in the space, I think, that's one of the hangups as well. It's like, oh, the value, is, going all over the place. I don't know what to make of this. It doesn't seem like money as I'm used to it. And I think like pulling on that thread of like what volatility means for an economy is a super important thing. And I think you do that excellently in your writing. So first of all, I would just be curious, like how would you respond to the President's Economic Report on that?
Yeah, so I think that I don't have a lot of respect, obviously, for academic economists and certainly not White House economists, but that's not specific to the Biden administration. Because practically speaking, how we've gotten to the mess where we're at has been decades in the making. But how I would respond to it probably most, kind of fundamentally is that, and it's not even the academic economist, like if you go to Goldman Sachs, there was this great, not great in the sense the presentation was great, but Goldman Sachs had the same thing. They were basically, Bitcoin can't be a currency because it's not a store of value, it's too volatile. And then it says, they literally had a quote that says, the dollar, loses value, is a store of value because it loses value predictably 2% a year. And, a dollar today is worth 82 cents that a dollar was worth, 10 years ago. And it's like, okay, here are the Goldman Sachs, the smartest guys in the room, saying that a store of value loses 18% over a decade. And that, well, it depends on how you define a store of value. In my book, it's something that holds value over time. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be worth more or less tomorrow or the next day, but over time, and particularly over longer time horizons, that the underlying properties of something that you hold will allow it to purchase more in the future versus less in the future. And that when people are evaluating money in the market, what goods can or can't be money, one thing is certain: the dollar is engineered to lose value, and that is a certainty. They print money, they target it, right? So right now they're targeting 2% inflation, but realistically it's running far higher than that, and whatever they're reporting, it's actually higher than that. And so that is not actually storing value. Like there's nothing about something degrading in value gradually that establishes it be a store of value. There's also the idea that something is volatile does not prevent it from storing value. So Bitcoin is an example of something that is both volatile. It can go up and down on any given day, but because it has a fixed supply, the reason that people adopt it over time, the reason why people come to understand it as money is for the fact that it has a fixed supply, and only more people figure that out as a function of time. Less people don't figure that out. So people's understanding of it exists on a spectrum, and that as more people figure it out over time, by definition, if 10x the number of people are going to adopt Bitcoin, it will have to be volatile because 9 out of 10 people that are going to own it in the future do not own it today. And anybody, by definition, who's going to own it in the future is going to have to price it for the first time. And the first time that somebody's pricing Bitcoin is going to be with inherently less information than from every point from there into the future, from 1 year into the future, 2 years in the future, 3 years, and so on. And so Bitcoin is volatile on a day-to-day basis, but it stores value over time. The dollar is not volatile day to day, but it's a very poor store of value. And ultimately, the ability of something to store value is not tied necessarily to its day to day volatility. Over time, as more people adopt Bitcoin, Bitcoin will become less volatile. And at its end state, when the entire world owns Bitcoin and uses Bitcoin as money, it will not be volatile. It will be a unit of account, perfectly stable, and it will be the currency that everything else is priced in. And the way that we get there, it's like the question to ask is, if Bitcoin were too volatile to be money, why does its volatility not prevent adoption? Because it doesn't empirically. People continue to adopt Bitcoin and it continues to be volatile. And the reality is, and this is where it becomes, you know, it's like these people are so academic, that Bitcoin adoption is not 100% an all or nothing thing. When I began adopting Bitcoin, I did not just convert all my money to Bitcoin or all my other assets to Bitcoin. And so if you start thinking about Bitcoin adoption, if I had 1% of my money in Bitcoin or 50% of my money in Bitcoin and I have a bunch of other assets too, houses, cars, stocks, bonds. I personally don't own any stocks and bonds, but I'm using as an example that you mute Bitcoin's volatility and can benefit from its ability to store value over time by diversification and allocating a certain percentage of your savings to Bitcoin. And that as more people do that, then Bitcoin over time will not be as volatile, but then also your exposure to its volatility is muted by that very fact that it's not an all or nothing proposition. So that's how I would, you know, kind of frame it holistically.
My fellow plebs, come celebrate Bitcoin Winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from Miami 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLive to get 10% off your tickets before prices go up. Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com. As 2023 begins, the broke issue stares head on into the looming realities of a broken economy, a more broke central bank, and considers how Bitcoiners can share their knowledge, their projects, and their mentalities to remain strong economic nodes throughout the winter. As a global Bitcoin news medium with a mission to accelerate hyper-Bitcoinization, Bitcoin Magazine is for all Bitcoiners, the curious, convicted, and the maximalists. Inside Bitcoin Magazine, you will find exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, and powerful photos and artwork from the best artists in the world. Each issue will be shipped safely in a secure box mailer to protect the integrity of each copy. Print magazines, not money. Buy Bitcoin Magazine.
Another kind of point to pick on as it relates to volatility, I know in the article I pinned at the top of the nest, you quote Leb, where he writes that volatility is information. And that's kind of one of the things that kind of catches my eye is kind of we've been, you know, pumping easy money into the economy to keep these zombie companies going, not allowing the market process to occur, dampening volatility over time. And it just makes me feel as though like the market process is losing its ability to convey information. And so like on that point, like how do you see the current fiat financial system as it relates to information processing? I know you talk about Hayek's piece, the use of knowledge in society. And that seems to be like a pretty deeply interwoven idea into, you know, how you approach Bitcoin. So I was hoping you could kind of comment on the need for volatility in an economy.
Yeah. So I would, on this one, so I would start at the idea, because I think that one of the hardest things for people to understand about Bitcoin, it really has little to do with Bitcoin, has everything to do with money, and that people look at a sea of 1,000 cryptocurrencies and like, how do you know which one's going to be? And it becomes obvious once you start to understand that the most important thing about money is its supply, Bitcoin's incredibly fixed, but also this idea that money converges to one, that humans, in order to trade, they actually it's necessary that they come to a consensus as to what money that they use. Because if you think about trade as an intersubjective problem, if I'm going to trade with somebody, I have to have the form of money that they're willing to accept. And then the question is, well, how do they agree on which form of money? And it's for objective reasons, and the most important one is supply. Well, when the entire world converges on a form of money, the output of that convergence on one form of money is a price system. And a price system is, you know, not a finitely defined thing, but it's the price of gas, the price of a house, the price of food at the grocery store, any price you could think of. Your own salary is a price. And so you have to realize that the existence of a price system is dependent on convergence on one form of money. The output is a price system. Well, what the Fed has is, quote, a price stability mandate. And what that really means is that they have a mandate to manipulate prices. And the example that I often use is that in 2007, when there was a housing crisis, there was an imbalance in housing prices. And that as those prices were coming down, the Fed printed money to target a value of real estate, to manipulate the value of real estate such that the value of real estate in dollar terms for that period of time would remain stable, but they did it by devaluing the value of a dollar of where it would otherwise have been set by the market. And, you know, the quote that you use that variability is information, or that changes in price are really information, that what the market was communicating was that the value of homes needed to go down. And what the Fed did was actually prevent the variability in price, which was the market communicating information to each other. And so over time, as the Fed, via its quote price stability mandate and its price manipulation mandate, as it allows, what it's functionally doing is it's allowing imbalances in the economic system to be sustained. And imbalances are just that. The economic system is out of balance, and rather than it be allowed to find balance, the Fed prints money and essentially communicates false price signals, false information, and leaves the economic system in this state of imbalance. But the state of imbalance is not just static. It causes imbalances to be exacerbated at the same time. And so the quality of information that the price signal that exists in the dollar world, where this entire, you know, 300 million person economy that realistically reaches billions of people via supply chains that are cross-border, the information, it doesn't just ossify, the price system becomes impaired, and that as prices change in ways that are impacted by a change in supply of money, the money's ability to actually coordinate trade breaks down, and that eventually that ends in hyperinflation, partly because they're printing money and then partly because the imbalances have grown and been sustained for very long periods of time. And there's so little balance in the economy that trade can't be coordinated on a sustainable basis. And then one day the currency fails completely. So it is all tied back to this. Prices communicating information. Prices only exist because you converge on a single form of money in which to trade. And what Bitcoin represents, and coming back to this idea of volatility, is it provides a currency with a perfectly stable supply schedule, but that everything else changes around it. And when we're in this adoption phase, the price is highly variable, because very, you know, on a grand scheme of things, still very a small percentage of people have any material exposure to Bitcoin, albeit that's growing. It's not insignificant in size. And its price is able to change. And the way, and what that ultimately means is information is being communicated to the market constantly. As its price crashes, somebody needed to access dollars for that period of time, and someone stepped in to buy it, and imbalance is eliminated. Because Bitcoin allows for the price to freely fluctuate on the market, both up and down, imbalances are constantly eliminated. If more people want to demand Bitcoin, it's going to force the price higher, and then the market is going to be communicated information. That information is ultimately that there's a market signal here that Bitcoin is valuable. And as more and more people price Bitcoin, ultimately the script becomes flipped. Bitcoin will become the stable thing that everything is priced in, but enough people have to value Bitcoin and price it in order for that script to flip and for it to become the unit of account. That is an inevitability if Bitcoin credibly enforces its fixed supply. And I think many people probably on here understand that, but more people will figure it out. And as they do, that's the function by which, yes, Bitcoin will be volatile day to day. And even when Bitcoin is perfectly stable as a unit of account, its price will change. It just won't be observed. It will be changed in the fact that the gas station changes slightly on a daily basis. The food at the grocery store changes slightly, or a business will fail because they couldn't clear a market price for their good, and a new business will emerge. That basically the change in the price of Bitcoin will be in the actual end market goods, because Bitcoin won't be sold for dollars anymore in that day. It will just be facilitating direct commerce.
Parker, you know, I think like some of the interviews, people kind of contest this idea of like, you know, the world may not be able to work that way, but I don't want to contest it. I kind of just want to lean in and ask you, when you envision a world that operates off of a sound money where the market can correct imbalances, as you put it, what does that world look like to you?
I think, well, one, it means that everything is priced in Bitcoin, and you go to the gas station and you pay in Bitcoin, and it's priced in Bitcoin, probably like sats. It's like, hey, a gallon of gasoline is 3 sats, a ribeye is 8 sats, and that every country in the world, its local economies are all operating on Bitcoin, and all international trade is settled in Bitcoin. And it doesn't mean that there won't be recessions. It's not like this utopian world. Like, people will still speculate. They'll still overinvest. There will still be people will lend Bitcoin. Like people think that there can't be lending on a sound money standard, but there was a gold standard and there were loans. So I think that what it simply means is that a group of 12 people in Washington, D.C., or, you know, wherever they sit at their local Fed stations and teleport into the Fed meetings to make decisions won't be able to manipulate our money anymore. And that information will be communicated more accurately to the actual market participants. So I think that, you know, there's a couple of things that people say, that there won't be lending on a Bitcoin standard. And I don't believe that that's true. And they say that, you know, that people will just hoard money if it's increasing in value, but both of those are academic views that aren't grounded in reality. And that, you know, when you think about, you know, imagine the entire world working on a Bitcoin standard, there's 21 million Bitcoin and there's 8 billion people in the world. And not all those people use money, but most of them do or will or would if they had access to a form of money that was global and permissionless like Bitcoin. But just think about that. Fixed supply, 21 million, 8 billion people. And all 8 million people need to eat and drink water and, you know, in an ideal world would have power delivered to them. And, you know, in an ideal would have a basic healthcare needs, because people are born every day and people die every day and people get sick every day and people get better every day. So in a world where there's a perfectly fixed money supply and human beings have present needs for survival every single day, hard money will be, and the quality of those goods will just be better than in a world where the reverse, where money is debased and realistically people do not have an incentive to create value for others. So I can go deeper on any of those tangents, but it's everything's priced in Bitcoin. There's not an issue with hoarding money because everyone's got to eat, and it is possible to lend on a sound money standard. More people would just have savings and Bitcoin would increase in value by very nominal levels. And, you know, the lending system would be a small fraction probably of the total money supply. But just as there was lending on a sound money standard before, there will be loans on a Bitcoin standard.
Another angle on that I want to explore is the idea of savings and how important that is. Up in the Nest, we have pinned your article, Bitcoin is the Great Definancialization. And in that, you talk about how people confuse saving and risk-taking, where people view their investments as a form of saving. And to my eye, it's, you know, this inflation of the money causes people to move up the risk curve to kind of beat the inflationary hurdle rate to maintain their value over time. And when I think about a world built on Bitcoin versus a world built on inflationary money, to me, that's like one of the key differences is, you know, kind of taking away this systemic leverage that inflation induces. So I was hoping you could speak to that idea. Like, first of all, you know, how do you delineate the difference between saving and investing? And then, you know, how would Bitcoin, you know, fix that kind of paradigm or change that going forward?
Yeah, so I would say that savings, and my definition of it would be holding money, and that investing is putting money at risk with the goal, if that investment is successful, of earning more money. And that investing in stocks and bonds is investing, and it's putting money at risk. Now, it might be a portfolio, and we can, you know, kind of argue over definitions, but just for the purposes of this discussion, that's my perspective. And, you know, I can, you know, form arguments as to why it is, but that when you, if you think about, you know, at a very fundamental level, what a stock or a bond is money at risk. And that if you have an investment in a company, say an equity, public equity, there's a chance that that company goes bankrupt. The only reason why you would own that equity is for the expectation of future money. So it's money at risk. Same thing with a bond. If you own a bond, there's a potential that that company that owns the bond or the government defaults on it and that you don't get it back. The only reason why you would hold it over money is to make more money. And so I think that what has happened is, or kind of realistically, if you have money that is engineered to lose value, it creates the need to make your money grow. And everyone's conditioned, and I talk about this in the piece, Bitcoin's great definancialization, is that this very need that's been conditioned into everyone's mind of make your money grow, make your money grow, really became a necessity because money loses value. It doesn't mean that on a sound money standard, people won't invest. People will invest naturally because there's an economic incentive to do it. There's not an assurance that you're going to get your money back, but that if you deliver value to other people, you will be rewarded by having taken that risk. And individuals, and then as a society, people have an incentive to actually improve the condition of society. So I think that's the other thing that's missed, is that on a sound money center, there's a natural incentive to take risk. And so I think that, you know, when I bring this back to kind of a more practical application, it's that everyone that is just plowing money into stocks and bonds in their 401ks, they are taking a risk thinking about it as savings. And what they really need is just a form of money that will preserve its purchasing power. And that as people start to understand Bitcoin, what will happen as that really sets in on them is that it does not make sense to have a job, a profession, a craft, and then between the hours of 6 and 10 p.m. trying to be a stock trader. And it doesn't mean that all people with savings won't invest or shouldn't invest in something that they are an expert in, or that they have some incentive to put capital in to try to make a reality. That all those things will happen at the same time. But that's not what happens today. Money's engineered to lose value. People go to work. They're on this autopilot loop where they get a paycheck and says, hey, you know, your employer will match 4%. So here's 10 mutual funds, just plow your money into there and that savings. And what that really is doing is putting you back on the hamster wheel and putting your money at risk. And when people think that their 401k that's invested in a diversified stock portfolio is savings and is just like, that's what people do. Well, Silicon Valley Bank depositors thought that their deposits were money and money good. And they wouldn't have been if people didn't get bailed out. Your equity portfolio is money at risk. Your bond portfolio is money at risk. And that as people figure out that Bitcoin has a perfectly fixed supply and that they don't really need to make their money grow, they just need a better form of money, people are going to opt out of that broken system because the stock system and the bond system is just as broken as the money system. And they will opt for the simplicity of Bitcoin's fixed supply over structured financial risk. You're ultimately taking on several layers of counterparty risk. And so you're taking on a single company risk, or you're taking on a mutual fund and many layers of counterparty risk there. But that as people figure out that they don't need to take on that financial risk and that there's a better alternative, that the entire economic system will definancialize, that people will be able to go to work and they'll be able to just save money. And it won't all be utopia, but they won't have to spend their day consumed after work trying to reinvest their money. They'll just be able to focus on creating value in the real world and being able to save money. And that in that world, you know, where money preserves purchasing power, and I've experienced this myself with Bitcoin, you actually think about money a lot less when your money stores value. Because almost by definition, that when you know your money loses value, you constantly have to think about money because you constantly have to be creating more of it. And it's actually cathartic when you start to save in a form of money that works in your favor rather than against you. And your money working against you is your money purposefully being engineered to lose value over time. So people will have, you know, again, I don't expect everyone to do what I do, but I don't own a single stock or bond other than equity in the company that I work for or worked for or help advise. And I'm not saying that that's right for everybody, but I just figured out that that Bitcoin is better than all those things and bears less risk. But I also have a lot of experience with Bitcoin and understanding of Bitcoin and how to secure it and how to secure it without counterparty risk, which is something that we do at Unchained and we can help other individuals. So it all exists on a spectrum. But the idea of definancialization is you don't need stocks, you don't need bonds, you just need a better form of money and one that has the right and aligned incentives and a money that has a fixed supply meets that definition.
Love it. That was awesome. CK, feel free to hop in if you had a question.
Well, I like to kind of press Parker to kind of like explain a little bit further as much as I can. But, you know, when you think through like a world where people have a longer time preference and they have the ability to discern between good and bad quality products and have the ability to save without exposing themselves to risk, like, can you try to articulate some of the features of that society?
I think that the way that I would describe it is I always think it's easiest to think about individual decision points. And that, you know, if you're somebody that has Bitcoin as savings already today, you logically have dollars in Bitcoin. And that you spend your dollars very freely. And you can try to explain why that is. The way that I would explain it is that dollars are becoming more and more abundant. They're relatively easy for you to get. And you have this expectation that Bitcoin is going to appreciate in value. If you're doing it for the right reasons, it's because it has a fixed supply. You have some reason to explain why other people in the future are going to have to demand Bitcoin. And so the idea is that every day, like, now you're making decisions and you're spending your dollars very loosely, or at least very loosely relative to how you think about your Bitcoin as savings. You'll part with your dollars a lot easier than you'll part with your Bitcoin. But also, as you become a saver in Bitcoin, it does influence your decisions to purchase dollars, because you start your decisions of how you spend your dollars at the same time. So it's this idea that you spend your dollars a lot easier, a lot more loosely than your Bitcoin. But over time, as you start to save in Bitcoin, you think about your dollars and say, am I going to spend this on, you know, a bunch of liquor at the bar, or am I not going to go to the bar, and am I going to go, you know, stack sats? And so it makes you, when you're holding a form of money that you reasonably expect to increase in value, it just hardens every single financial decision. And that does not mean that every financial decision is perfect, but by reintroducing the opportunity costs of money, it puts greater calculus on average and in every individual decisions. And then when you start to stack up, well, if that's true for you, and then if it's true for a growing number of people, then in aggregate, you're going to get a lot higher quality outcomes. Because if I was to say, well, I'm not going to go spend my money on the booze at the bar, I'm going to stack sats, at some point you're going to say, I'm going to spend the Bitcoin on X or a ranch or that car or this. But it's basically you're filtering. You're basically setting your preferences, and your preferences are becoming more, not even constrained, but you're being more intentional. And that as a society starts to operate that way, and if you think about it, you're like, okay, I'm not gonna give up my Bitcoin because I think that it's gonna appreciate in value. But if you come to me with a high quality enough product, then I'll spend my Bitcoin. Because we all do have a finite life. So we all Safe talks about the concept of time preference a lot in the Bitcoin stand. We all have a positive time preference because we're not all going to be here forever. And we have an incentive to consume today. And that remains true on a Bitcoin standard. But the idea that you know, your money is appreciating in value just makes your individual economic decisions today kind of more scrutinized, and that you will spend your money. But, you know, if I think about, you know, you've got a fixed supply of a finite resource, and you're basically looking out in the market and saying, okay, I can only spend this once, and they're not making any more of it. And you got to come show me something really good if I'm going to part with it. But then the consequence of that is, once I do that, the person that I've just sold my Bitcoin to, and when I say sell it, thinking about it as trading it, that they bring me, you know, they build me a really nice house, and I give them my Bitcoin for that. Now they're in the same position. Everybody has to look at them and say, okay, I got to go to that person because I want the finite resource, because it's going to open up this range of possibilities that I can go buy things from the widest range of people in the future. So when you kind of start to think about it from a very individual decision point, how it's actually probably affecting you today, and that as more people operate on that standard, it just compounds, and you ultimately get better things built for the long term, because once you spend your Bitcoin, it can't be spent twice, and you better make a good trade. You're not going to make 100% good trades or 100% good decisions, but each one on the margin will be far better than it is today, because the exact opposite happens today. And I won't go through the same kind of through every point there, but when your money loses value, the reason why you spend your dollars a lot more quickly is because you have this expectation they will decrease in value. And there is this very perverse incentive where you think about, well, if I know that my money is going to purchase less in the future, guaranteed, I actually don't have an incentive to create value for other human beings. But if I know that if I were to opt into a form of money that could not be printed, that over time that money should improve in value or increase in value, that fact that the money increases in value actually creates the incentive for each human to go out and create value for other humans. And so the reverse is just true today. And that's why things degrade over time, is that you don't actually have an incentive to create value. If the second you create value, you're almost by definition guaranteed to not be able to recoup that value in the future, because it ultimately requires time to produce value. So that was a little bit of a rant, but I'll pause there.
No, I thought that was great. And I something, you know, that is kind of related to that is Bitcoin's use of energy. And, you know, what you previously just described is, you know, a better money allows us to facilitate trade, which is a positive sum game, therefore unlocking more value. And it would stand to reason that the better the money, the better it can facilitate trade, therefore the more value that can be created at scale. And I think you did a good job of unpacking, you know, why it is an inflationary money reduces the, you know, the aggregate value that people are incentivized to create. And to kind of tie this to, you have an article, I believe it's titled, "Coin Does Not Waste Energy." And in this, you write, "Venezuela is one of the most oil-rich countries in the world, but as an endgame function of monetary debasement, Venezuela's currency has recently hyperinflated. As its currency has deteriorated, basic economic functions have broken down to the point where getting food at grocery stores or basic healthcare is no longer the baseline. It's a full-on humanitarian crisis, and at the root level, it is a function of Venezuela no longer having a stable currency to coordinate economic activity." And, you know, to tie this back to the president's economic report, they you know, knock on Bitcoin for being, you know, environmentally unfriendly or using too much energy. And, you know, they cite DigiEconomist, which is, you know, laughable. But that aside, like, I think it's, you know, it's so clear, you know, what the value of, or what the use of money is for society and how important it is to maintain that money. And so I think it's really important to, like, kind of unpack the relationship between Bitcoin and energy. So first of all, like, if somebody said, you know, Bitcoin is a waste of energy, you know, what would you say to that?
So I would start with, anyone who doesn't understand why Bitcoin is valuable could never either justify the cost to secure it or understand why any energy resources are devoted to it. So if you don't understand why Bitcoin is valuable, if you don't understand why Bitcoin is money, you don't understand that the reason that it's valuable is that there will only ever be 21 million. And then connect that idea that the relevance of the 21 million is that it serves as a sound monetary foundation for the entire world, then you could very reasonably think that Bitcoin wastes energy. And let's all accept that most people don't understand Bitcoin. So they're looking there and being like, these guys are just running, you know, gigawatts of power, you know, 24/7, and this is Fugazi. And it's like, well, no, it's not, but you don't understand. So I'd start there. And I'd also say that if somebody doesn't understand why Bitcoin is valuable, then they are not only incapable, but they have no credibility to even talk about. So it's like, that's the starting point. Then, you know, on a more fundamental level, Bitcoin's energy use is used to secure its fixed supply. So if Bitcoin is valuable because there will only ever be 21 million, that doesn't happen by magic. It doesn't happen because there's magic software code that says there will only ever be 21 million. Software is part of it, but also a core part of what secures the 21 million is real world energy resources. The real world energy resources, which are natural gas being converted to power and power running computers to secure the Bitcoin network. That's what I mean by real world energy resources, that nothing of value comes without cost. And in this case, the thing of value is Bitcoin's fixed supply, and a big part of what secures it is real world energy resources. So when I say that Bitcoin does not waste energy, the energy is actually going to a very important cause, and that's securing the monetary foundation of the entire world. Now, when I think about this connection between money and energy, it is that money and energy exists as the first and second order goods from which all other goods in society are derived. If you do not have money and energy, good luck getting clean water to your house, and good luck getting power to your house, and good luck getting medicine. Basically, money coordinates trade, and energy coordinates all of the inputs to get everything else to you. And that's also the thing that's comical about all these ESG LARPs that hate hydrocarbons and natural gas and coal. I won't go on that rant just yet. But point being is that when you start to think about energy, and then there's two things. People take money for granted, right? And when I said before that the hardest thing to understand about Bitcoin has very little to do with Bitcoin and everything to do with money, and that most people just don't understand money. And it's because if they've lived in the United States or lived in Europe or Japan or some developed world country, money's just existed and it's generally worked and it's been taken for granted, and it's never taught for that reason that it's taken for granted. So money is taken for granted, but then also energy is taken for granted. And even probably a lot of, like, from a society perspective, outside of people that work in the energy industry, a lot of Bitcoiners probably even take energy for granted. And then as they start to really understand Bitcoin, then they start to understand the significance of energy. But when I say that energy is taken for granted, that until you go out and see an oil well or start to understand the complexity of a modern power grid, the process of getting, say, natural gas out of the ground from an oil well or a natural gas well, and refining it and the process that's required to refine it, and then the process to say build a natural gas turbine and then to run natural gas through that and convert that to power and then pipe it over a transmission line, and the fact that, like, using the state of Texas as an example, 35 million people can all get power on demand when they want it. Like, that is taken for granted. Highly complex, taken for granted. And if you go back to the inception of it, think about an oil well. Even if you've never been out to an oil well, just imagine an oil derrick, and realistically, derricks don't look the same as they did, you know, probably the derrick that you're imagining. But think about, like, one oil well and the supply chain that would be required to get oil out of the ground and natural gas out of the ground, that the production of all of the components, and there's hundreds, if not thousands, and then there's all the labor as well, that money coordinates trade, and that money is the requirement of the actual manufacturing of the inputs that require energy to be extracted out of the ground. And so when I talk about, and then if I carry that forward to all of the, you know, kind of points in the process, you get the oil and natural gas out of the ground, you got to get it in a pipeline, and then you got to send it to a refinery, and then you got to, or a natural gas processing plant, and then you got to take the natural gas that's processed and get it into a turbine, but that turbine had to be built, and then you had to convert it to power, and then you needed transmission lines, and you needed to pipe it into homes, and you got 30 million people in Texas all demanding power at different hours. All of those points are coordinated by the function of money. And so when I say that money and energy are the first and second order goods, really in that order, in terms of the delivery of all other goods, that you do not have energy. And if you do not have energy, you do not have power. And if you do not have power, like, how do you clean water to your home? Well, there's a water and waste management system that also requires money to trade and energy to run, and then energy to pipe the water to you. And same thing with air conditioning and heat. Now, you don't have any of those things without a functioning money. And when governments destroy money, which is what happened in Venezuela, you no longer have money, and then you no longer have energy, and then your society goes back several generations into something that looks, that resembles more closely the Dark Ages than the comfort that we get to enjoy in the United States. And the point is that printing money has the same impact whether you're in Venezuela or you're in the United States. And believing that they're different is just the fact that you don't understand how money works, because the cost to produce a Venezuelan bolivar, or print a Venezuelan bolivar, is the same that it costs to print a US dollar. It is zero functionally. And if it costs zero to produce a dollar, it costs zero to produce $3 trillion. And that's exactly what happened over the 3 months following the government lockdown in 2020. Since that began, governments or the feds produced $5 trillion all at a cost of zero. And that when money fails, energy fails, and that has massive societal consequences. So when I bring this all the way back to the beginning, it is that Bitcoin does not waste energy because money is this very basic necessity, and without it, we can't trade. And not being able to trade means no clean water, no power, no healthcare. And if you kind of don't believe it, it's not dystopian. It's happened time and time again as fiat currencies hyperinflate, and fiat currencies hyperinflate because governments print money at zero. And I use Venezuela as an example, not to belittle it, but it's a forewarning. And it's also an example of Venezuela has just about more energy underneath its soil than any other country in the world. And it happened to them. And Venezuela was one of the wealthiest countries in the world at one point, and that was taken for granted, and socialism ran over it. The socialists printed just as much money as they're printing here and now. And any money that goes to secure the Bitcoin network ultimately ensures that we have a reliable form of money. And I say we, I mean I and everyone else that uses it. And it's also available to the entire world. And so when you think about the importance of energy use, in my view, and I talk about it in that piece, Bitcoin does not waste energy, is that there's actually no higher and better use for energy than any energy that would go to secure the monetary system. And that energy that secures the monetary system ultimately secures all other demand for energy, because with a functioning money, it is that functioning money that will ensure that all the other things that you demand in your daily lives, the food, the water, the power, the healthcare, will continue to be delivered. Without it, it all goes away, or it becomes, at the very least, it doesn't show up to your door as easily as it does today. That whole coordination trade function becomes massively impaired. And that's the direction that we're heading, and Bitcoin fixes it.
Very well said, Parker. Really appreciate, how concisely you're able to kind of break down these complex subjects. And another complex subject along the line of like what Bitcoin does, you mentioned like as fiat breaks down, energy doesn't get to your door as easily or in an efficient manner like it does today in the first world. Can you talk through the implications of Bitcoin in terms of actually improving that? We've seen, across the globe, really, Bitcoin mining demonstrating that it's like this modular first purchaser of energy and shows the potential to finance energy projects. Talk through like the implication of what Bitcoin mining is doing to the world and like what it means in terms of the energy that people have access to.
Yeah, so I think that, and I'll just talk about Texas because it's something I can speak to, but it applies more broadly, but I'll use it as an example and then talk about it kind of in the broader context. So one, there's a recognition that Bitcoin is still small relative to the broader financial system, and that as Bitcoin becomes larger, it becomes a more significant demand of energy. And as Bitcoin becomes a more significant demand for energy, it can actually more materially help solve problems that exist in the, kind of fundamentally with how energy is produced and demanded. And I should say specifically power. Energy needs to be converted to power. And today, at least in the United States, the primary underlying feedstocks for energy are natural gas, coal, and nuclear, and increasingly, but probably to our detriment, wind and solar. So when I explain this to people, it is that Bitcoin's energy demand is 24/7. And the reason why it is so unique is because the source of demand is the Bitcoin network. So there's this one source of demand that's aggregated, and Bitcoin miners are individual suppliers distributed all over the world to the Bitcoin network. And so if I was using an example, this does not equate, I expect roughly today there's, no one knows for sure, but somewhere between 10 and 20 gigawatts. I've seen estimates of 10, I've seen 15, I've seen 20. To put context into that, in a peak summer month in Texas alone, we consume 80 gigawatts of power. So, and that's why I mean that as Bitcoin becomes larger, it actually becomes able to solve more problems because the size of the demand actually needs to be higher. And I'll explain that. But say there's 20 miners and they each have 1 gigawatt, and miners are much smaller than this, but I'll use an example that if one miner had to go down completely, Bitcoin still has 95% of the energy and it still continues to function perfectly well. If you shut down a hospital, the hospital can't function. If you shut down a semiconductor plant, the plant can't function. Bitcoin can function when individual miners go offline, and that is why, it can function, practically speaking, without interruption, because more realistically, one miner might only represent 1%, and if a miner was shutting down one mine, it would probably only be 0.1%, and most miners don't even represent 1%. A miner might represent 0.1%, particularly as the Bitcoin network grows, each miner on average will become less and less on a percentage basis. So if a small percentage of the network shuts down, network continues to function, practically speaking, without any interruption. And that is a very unique source of demand. What it means is that Bitcoin miners can respond in their local markets more so than any other source of demand. And it is because of that nature that any miner is less critical to the overall operation. And so the way that this works out in practice is that when I talk about the energy demand in Texas in a peak month, and at the peak in Texas, it's approximately 80 gigawatts. Well, in a trough of a year, it's somewhere like 30 to 40 gigawatts. And so a lot of power generation has to come online in order to be able to satisfy the seasonal variations. But in those summer months, that when the demand is spiking, particularly a few days a year, that Bitcoin miners can actually shut down to be able to deliver the power that they are otherwise demanding for, say, the other 360 days of the year, such that more generation doesn't have to come online. And so as Bitcoin mining, if I think about the problem in Texas, that it's actually a really complicated problem to turn energy generation up for short periods of time to be able to satisfy, but that's functionally speaking what every grid is doing in the world of balancing supply and demand. And it would be a lot easier or a lot more efficient, and power would actually be a lot cheaper if demand was more stable, if there was more baseload, if there was more 24/7 demand, and the demand could actually shut off rather than bringing supply and generation up. And that's functionally speaking what Bitcoin mining can and is representing. And as Bitcoin grows, it will be able to do that more realistically or on a more broad-based way. So imagine rather than Texas having to ramp up 40 gigawatts of power? What if there was just 80 gigawatts of power? And ESG LARPers will be like, oh, that's terrible for the environment. It would actually be great for the environment. But what it would mean would be, say, hey, if we had 80 gigawatts of power running all year round, then 40 gigawatts doesn't need to turn up. And that as demand increases in the real economy, Bitcoin miners can shut down. And then as the demand troughs, then Bitcoin miners can turn back up. And essentially what is happening is this highly complex problem of matching power production and power demand, which varies greatly in a single day, as well as greatly from a summer month to the winter month. Bitcoin mining helps fix that by being able to respond to the market. But the only reason why that exists is because Bitcoin miners can shut down without impacting the functioning of the Bitcoin network. And people have a hard time understanding that without understanding just how complicated the whole power dynamic is. Like, you want to appreciate somebody, go like meet the person who's actually delivering power to you, or start just thinking about the complexity of the problem of the fact that when you turn the light switch on, boom, power comes on. Like, everyone takes that for granted. Highly complex problem. And it is highly complex because energy supply is variable and energy demand is variable. And Bitcoin being a base load and being able to be both 24/7 large in size, but being able to be shut down at a moment's notice without the underlying operation that power was supporting going from on to off, which is what happens when a Bitcoin miner shuts down. A Bitcoin miner shuts down, Bitcoin network doesn't stop working. But if power gets shut off to a hospital stops working. That is fundamentally in nature why Bitcoin can help solve a real world energy dynamic and problem. And then what the consequence of that will also be is that energy will be more efficient and power will be cheaper and power will be able to be delivered more reliably to more people too.
Great job. You're on fire, man. So unfortunately, we're kind of getting to the end here. But, you know, I definitely want to, you know, talk about the fact that energy literacy is going to be one of the things that gives Bitcoiners an edge, you know, as the world changes with Bitcoin and as kind of the existing system that we are living in has to adapt to the fact that Bitcoin is here, Bitcoin mining exists. And, you know, exactly like Parker articulated, it's going to fundamentally change the calculation of energy production and how it affects the world. You know, in terms of energy literacy, that's one of the biggest topics that we're trying to talk about at the Bitcoin conference. It's all about financial literacy and sound money and economic literacy and energy literacy, which is a massive part of the cocktail that is Bitcoin and the Bitcoin movement. So I really want to encourage everyone there that, you know, you need to come to this event. It's going to be the biggest Bitcoin bear market event in history. We have thousands of Bitcoiners already confirmed. And, you know, there's always a wave of FOMO at the end. So don't be part of that wave. Get your ticket today. Ticket prices are going up at the end of this week. And you're not going to want to miss this event. So Parker, excited to see you in Miami once again and give you a hug. I really appreciate you coming on. So thanks a lot.
Well, I was at the bear market Bitcoin conference in 2019, and that might have been the largest bear market Bitcoin conference at that time. So I'm sure that this will be probably an order of magnitude larger than that one. And that one was awesome. And I expect the same of the one in May.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I remember hanging out quite a bit there. So
yeah, and it's been
kind of a tradition here at this point.
If anybody out there is on the fence of going to the Bitcoin conference, I would say absolutely get there. One, we just had a Bitcoin takeover here in Austin at the Commons. Being around Bitcoiners in the bear market, it's important. Like, you will never regret it. You learn, deepen knowledge, connect with people you might have met or know online. And it's just a great excuse to get around Bitcoiners, and you can tangibly feel the energy, and you can, you know, you'll always leave with greater intentionality of not just your, you know, not only a greater understanding of Bitcoin, but greater intentionality if you want to work, contribute on Bitcoin to go forth and do that, that it's a galvanizing force and spirit that you get to when you get to those conferences, and especially in the bear market.
Yeah, well said. Looking forward to meeting you there, Parker. Really looking forward to the event as a whole, too. You know, the whole Bitcoin conference and Bitcoin magazine teams are working really hard to make it super special for everyone. So I think it's going to be an awesome time. So yeah, looking forward to seeing everybody there. And to kind of wrap things up, I think it would be ill-advised to not at least comment on the banking crisis that is currently underway. Kind of the long story short is that, you know, the Fed has kind of torched a lot of banks that held long-dated U.S. government bonds, and people are waking up to the idea of counterparty risk with their bank deposits. You know, we've had some large bank failures, potentially more to come, and, you know, a lot of drama today around the Fed raising rates yet another time. And, you know, people are beginning to question, you know, is this money in my bank account mine? And as Parker mentioned earlier, it may not even be money, which is a kind of a, you know, funny twist there. But Parker, if you had any comments on this banking crisis, it could be, you know, as simple as, you know, somebody who's new to Bitcoin and, you know, they're coming to you like, hey, you know, I've seen all these bank failures go on. You know, is Bitcoin something I should consider? Or like, you know, what are your thoughts on just the general state of things, if you have anything to share with the audience there?
Yeah, so I mean, I think on this, in the subject, which it is, it's incredibly serious. I think that, you know, what happened, you know, I guess it was only like, it was less than 2 weeks ago, you know, on a Thursday, there were reports of a bank run with Silicon Valley Bank. And by Friday at 11 a.m., Silicon Valley Bank, which was, as of the end of 2022, $173 billion deposit bank, was taken over by the FDIC. And then within 2 days, Signature Bank, which I think it was like $100 billion deposit bank, was also taken over by the FDIC. And that ultimately the depositors, the uninsured and insured depositors, or the uninsured depositors, were ultimately backstopped by the Fed and the FDIC and the Treasury. But those were bank failures. And realistically, the reason why they happened is because, you know, in my view, the system as a whole is insolvent. And they were spurred because over the last 12 months, the Fed has reacted to the inflation that it caused by printing trillions of dollars, not just in the years following COVID, but even before that, following the great financial crisis. Printing trillions of dollars creates inflation. The only thing that creates inflation, monetary inflation, is the fact that the Fed has created trillions more dollars. And that as that started to create a more observed and rapid rate of inflation, the Fed perceived itself to be behind the eight ball and started massively reducing the supply of dollars in the system, and that caused bank runs. And what that's woken people up to is a few things. The fact that the deposits in their banks might not actually be there, and in most cases they aren't, but when the Fed and the Treasury and the FDIC came in to bail out the depositors at Silicon Valley Bank and Signature, they did not guarantee all other deposits. And that there's one thing that, in my view, is certain, is that this all stems from the fact that there's far too much debt in the system and there are not enough dollars. And that circumstance is what guarantees many more trillions of dollars are going to be printed. The only way that the dollars could be guaranteed in those two banks was that they're going to have to print more money in order to do it. That there's been discussion as to whether or not they're going to insure all uninsured deposits, which I think is another something like 10 to 13 trillion of deposits. The only way for that to be possible would be to print money. And whether they print money as a function of backstopping uninsured deposits, the Federal Reserve will have to print money in order to keep the credit system more broadly from collapsing. And the consequence of that is that the inflation that you're experiencing at the grocery store and that you're going to be or already experiencing at the gas station or wherever it is in your life, trying to purchase a home over time and recognizing that, you know, maybe the prices of homes are coming down right now, but as they have to print more money, the prices of homes will go up, that each dollar that you earn is going to purchase less in the future. And that is what Bitcoin fixes. And that Bitcoin is volatile, but it stores value over time because it represents a form of money that can't be printed. And that people need to save in Bitcoin. And if they do, they need to be very aware that Bitcoin is volatile and, you know, there's no moral hazard in Bitcoin. And you have to have 100% personal accountability that if you save in Bitcoin, it could go down tomorrow, and that you can't save more in Bitcoin than not that you not it's the right way to think about it is not what you can afford to lose, but you have to be able to save to such a level that you can tolerate the volatility because the volatility is real. But over time, it stores value for the reason that it can't be printed. And that what is certain is that the Fed has already in the last week, but will have to continue to print money. And that is a problem, not because just that the goods will become slightly more expensive over time, but ultimately it results in the currency failing. And if people do not want to go through the uncomfortable thought process of what happens when a government or a central bank creates trillions of dollars at zero cost, it's not logic to say that they had to do it. It will end poorly, and it happens for very known reasons, and it's because there is way too much debt in the system and there aren't enough dollars. The only way to pay for the debt is to print more dollars. And that Bitcoin's the path to opt out. But you have to do that with intentionality. You have to do it with personal responsibility. You have to do it with an understanding. If you have it, if you don't, you need to gain it. And there's plenty of resources out there to learn, but only you can spend the time and invest the time to gather the knowledge and to be able to, you know, I like to say Bitcoin has a fixed supply, but it's not a value to you if you don't understand it. And it's not a value to you if you buy Bitcoin and lose it by putting it at some place like FTX or Celsius or BlockFi. That the responsibility is yours, both to educate yourself as well as to know how to own Bitcoin and to secure it responsibly.
Love it. Super well said, man. You know, I really appreciate you coming on today. And I know CK does as well. You covered an absolutely insane amount of ground, everything from energy systems to information processing and economies to banking failures, fiat debasement, all across the board. So this was, you know, a lot of fun for me, learned a lot as well. And I guess the last thing is, I would just be curious, you know, is there anything you're working on these days or anything that's caught your attention as of late? You know, perhaps anything we didn't cover here, but the floor is yours if you have any parting thoughts.
Working on turning my series Gradually Then Suddenly. The articles that we talked about are on Unchained's website. You can go to the blog and find Gradually Then Suddenly, and all the articles that we talked about are there and more. And then I'm working on turning that collection of essays into a book. I like to think I'm like 90% there. Maybe I'll have a final transcript by the Bitcoin conference. I don't think the book will be out by then, but I might be starting to at least distribute the manuscript in a way that people can download it online before the print version comes out. So be looking out for that. In addition to that, you know, if people are ready to take the step of holding their own keys, they can come to the folks at Unchained, unchained.com, and go to the, I think it's unchained.com/concierge. You can have somebody hold your hand to help you take on that responsibility. So know that resource is there as well. And then the only other thing I would mention is on the concept of energy. We're in the process of launching at the Bitcoin Commons in Austin, which Austin is the de facto Bitcoin capital world. So if you ever come through town, come do an event at the Commons and say hello and meet the Bitcoiners here, or just save yourself some trouble and just go ahead and move here because there's a lot of Bitcoiners already here. But one of the things that we're working on is a debate series. The first one will be in April 26th, just before the Bitcoin conference, but it will be on energy. And it will be a debate on whether or not, or essentially whether or not, and it will be affirmative of the debate, will hydrocarbons are the most sustainable source of energy to mine Bitcoin, more so than wind and solar. Jesse Pelton will take the side of wind and solar. Steve Barber will take the side of hydrocarbons. And Tur de Meester will be moderating the debate. It will be the first of a debate. The Nakamoto Forum debate series, we'll be doing them quarterly here at the Bitcoin Commons. So be on the lookout for an announcement around that. And people can grab tickets and come to Austin. Or if you're here in Austin, you can buy a ticket. It's always a good excuse. It's during a shitcoin conference, but that's why we're doing it then. And then the Bitcoin Plus conference will be in Austin that weekend too. So be on the lookout of all that. And you can also find me on Twitter at Parker A. Lewis. And yeah, that's pretty much it. And I'm looking forward to the Bitcoin conference in May.
Awesome. Thank you so much, man. And I know you mentioned Tur de Meester, who will be in attendance at that debate. He will actually be joining us next week on Cosmic Bitcoin. So next Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. So really looking forward to hosting him as well. CK, you got anything for us before we get out of here?
Hopefully I can convince you, Parker, to plan one of those debates for the Bitcoin conference as part of Bitcoin Week. But I'll have to DM you after that, or after this to see if I can make something like that happen.
Absolutely. I'll take it offline.
All right, y'all. Thanks again for showing. Parker, this is a great space. This is recorded and it's going to be available here on Twitter, but we're also going to be publishing it on the Bitcoin Magazine podcast feed. So feel free to subscribe to that. We're everywhere that you get your podcast, and you can even send us sats on the Fountain Podcast app. So check that out. And yeah, come to the Bitcoin conference. You know, I feel like I've beat a dead horse on that, so I'll stop. But we'll see everyone next week with Mr. Tour de Meester. Thanks. Bye.
My fellow plebs, come celebrate Bitcoin Winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from Miami 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLive to get 10% off your tickets before prices go up. Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com. As 2023 begins, the broke issue stares head-on into the looming realities of a broken economy, a more broke central bank, and considers how Bitcoiners can share their knowledge, their projects, and their mentalities to remain strong economic nodes throughout the winter. As a global Bitcoin news medium with a mission to accelerate hyper-Bitcoinization, Bitcoin Magazine is for all Bitcoiners, the curious, convicted, and the maximalists. Inside Bitcoin Magazine, you will find exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, and powerful photos and artwork from the best artists in the world. Each issue will be shipped safely in a secure box mailer to protect the integrity of each copy. Print magazines, not money. Buy Bitcoin Magazine.